Well, hopefully you feel fine today, even if it could be almost the end of the world. Now, we like to have a little humor here on Green Zine. That is the show you're listening to right now, REM behind me. Henry will be joining me here shortly, but while Michael Stipe continues to sing, we want to acknowledge Soloflect and Bale. Royal Trail Works just saw Tom Wells over there at the market. Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solar Fest, the White River Land Collaborative, and Wit and Grit. Got a jam-packed show. We're trying to make a last-minute connection with a law school professor emeritus here to talk about a case in Montana. Henry will be with us in just a moment. I'm going to bring this down and see if we've got Henry connected. Are you there, Henry? He should be in the system. Let's see. He's probably trying to get our guest. One more time, Henry. Nope. We'll go back to music. We'll bring that down in the mix. You are listening to Green Zine here. It's 3 minutes past 11 on this somewhat snowy Thursday. It seems to have tapered off quite a bit. Henry will be joining me here shortly. Just going to zap around here on the big screen. Yeah. And I got a lot of things we could go into here. You know what? I'm going to start off with, let me just check. Henry, are you there for Bird Note? No sign of Henry yet, so he's still trying to get a hold of our guest. We're going to go. He's picked out a couple of bird notes here, and this one is on migration. We try to check in with the birds every week. In fact, Henry is going to be producing a promo for this show, which I think will also include some bird sounds. But this one is titled Migration, Innate or Learned, and we're going to learn. Oh, here's Henry coming back. Well, maybe we are going to put Henry on. Let's hit that, and... Can you hear me now, Henry?
Yep.
All right. You're on the air. I'm just about to introduce Bird Note, but I'm going to have you do it. But anyway, let's just catch up. First of all, any luck with getting a hold of our guest?
No, I tried the law school switchboard, and they're shut down.
Yeah.
So they can't talk to a real person.
Yeah.
I have emailed him, which is the best I have for a promotion for how to reach Patrick Parento.
Yeah.
He knows we're going to be on today. Maybe he will look to see.
Yeah, check his email if he hasn't seen. Yeah. Anyway, we're hoping to have Pat Parento on. We'll get into maybe details of that when we know whether he's going to be with us or not.
All right. So just to get into the flow of what's going on, so Bird Note's about, decisions that birds make to migrate and not to migrate, and, how does food supply play a part in that, and lots of birds are around. The Christmas bird count up in the Burlington area had some things like green herons that are never here at this time of year, they counted. And so climate change is changing birds' behavior.
Indeed.
So I thought we'd – so there's two different pieces there that we can listen to.
Okay. We'll go ahead and we'll do them back to back. The first one is about migration. So thanks for joining us on Green Zine. Here we go, Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Two sure signs of fall are wintering waterfowl appearing on lakes and shorebirds settling into saltwater marshes. How do migrating birds manage to return to the same location year after year? Do they learn from their parents? Or do they just know how to migrate? The answer is both. After nesting in the far north, many shorebird parents leave their young and migrate south without them. A few weeks later, when the young are more mature, they must take flight on their own. Still, they manage to find their parents on the wintering grounds. These birds have the innate ability to know where to go. One amazing example is the bar-tailed godwit, a bird that begins life in northern Alaska. The parents are long gone when the young begin migrating, yet they link up with their parents 6,800 miles away in New Zealand. The young of other bird species, such as geese, need to be shown the way. The parents wait until the young are ready to migrate. Then, adults and young travel together, following familiar landmarks to their winter homes. Both ways of migrating are remarkable, and both work just fine. To see a photo of the amazing bar-tailed godwit, come to our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
This is Bird Note. The red-headed woodpecker spends its summers in farmyards, open woodlands, and treed suburbs, snatching insects from midair in flashy, acrobatic flight. Bugs are harder to come by in the winter, of course, so this type of woodpecker moves south, but not always. When autumn sees a bumper crop of acorns, beech nuts, and other large seeds, the birds stock up and linger in the north to feed through the winter. Not all woodpeckers are efficient food hoarders. The anthropologist George A. Dorsey once watched a young red-headed woodpecker stuffing acorns into a hole in a telephone pole. What that bird hadn't noticed was that the hole went all the way through to the other side of the pole, where the acorns he'd just stashed proceeded to tumble to the ground. No word on whether that red-headed woodpecker stayed through the winter or found his cupboards shockingly empty and decided to migrate south. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Bird Note gives you the sounds of birds every day, and you can get the sights as well when you follow us on Instagram at Bird Note Radio.
Oh, boy, that hole in the other side reminds me of that old song, My Bucket's Got a Hole in It, and I Just Can't Find No Beer. But hopefully he flew south. Henry, yeah, there you go. A little beer and birds together here on on Bird Note. That's a very attractive woodpecker, by the way, the photo of the red-headed. Now, do we find that? I don't think I've seen that particular woodpecker in our area.
No, I don't think they're here. I've never seen that bird.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's a western bird.
Right, because our listeners know.
I thought it was a great story.
Yeah, the head is completely red, all the way down to the collar, the neck of the bird, completely red, so really unique looking.
We have a red-breasted woodpecker that isn't really red-breasted. It's kind of a little bit of rose-colored to it.
Uh-huh.
And then we have the whole series that start off the pileated and work their way down to downy and hairy in between. And so those are sort of lookalikes. And then you've got a sapsucker, which is, I see in Tunbridge, but I've never seen in Burlington.
Hmm.
And so that's And I don't know if there's another Vermont woodpecker out there. You got any other woodpeckers
Did you just name? I was looking at our possibly our next story, but you did do the hairy, the downy, and the pileated. Got all three of those in?
Yes.
Yep. Okay. No, I can't think of any beyond that. No.
Okay.
Brian Lowe would know.
Flicker.
Yeah. A flicker. Yeah, a flicker. Yeah, I think
flicker.
We've got flickers.
That's the thing that I, yeah. Sapsucker and a flicker. I think that's the lot for at least for the main part of Vermont. Maybe when you get into the Northeast Kingdom, you get into some birds we don't have in the rest of the state.
Yeah, yeah. Huh.
So today, there's a series of things that that I've kind of come across that I think flow together. And the International Energy Agency has just recently announced that we will reach peak oil. So that's the point at which oil production will start to ramp down each year, that basically we will have exhausted our ability to get the natural supplies out. And that happened to us back in the early 2000s, and then fracking came along and opened all kinds of oil reserves up that had not been here before. But they're saying we're going to once again reach peak oil and in 2030, so not that far along, and then that means we can mine all the oil we want, or at least what we're doing now until then, but that there'll be less and less oil after that, so prices will definitely rise radically as time goes forward. And so that was one kind of benchmark I thought was kind of interesting. This is kind of a change of the year, time to do a few benchmarks. So Ukraine did a benchmark. They had honored a contract to allow a certain amount of gas to cross Ukraine into points east, including Europe. And the gas line to Europe, one of the gas lines to Europe was sabotaged, was blown up suspiciously by Ukraine, but that was never determined, which radically got the Europeans figuring out other energy sources rather than being dependent on Russian gas. The Russians went and sold as much as they could to China and points east. The Ukraine has finished their contract to allow that gas to cross their lands, and it'll cost them $1 million a year. They got a transit fee of about $1 million a year, and they will lose that by shutting us down. The gas that flows through that gas line they're shutting off is the CO2 equivalent of 5 million U.S. cars.
Hmm.
So a significant little dollop of reduction in gas supply. And some of it will come through other systems. It'll just be more expensive for the people that are getting it, but because it'll have to be piped all around Kingdom Come to get to a market. But it is the tightening up of actual fossil fuel supply as our demand doesn't seem to diminish no matter what we do.
Yeah, and, you know, these type of things,
so,
particularly, the geopolitical ramifications, like when you were, and I read this story earlier, and it is convenient, particularly at the coldest time normally in Europe this time of year, to have the gas line cut off, and maybe Russia would have cut it off anyway to, you know, as far as going through Ukraine. But this was a Ukrainian decision, and a lot of the Western European countries, particularly based on the last time this happened and even before that, have been transitioning and really becoming more dependent on wind and sun. And right now, Henry, in Europe, they are suffering from Dunkelflaut. Are you familiar with Dunkelflaut?
Whoa.
Huh?
It sounds like something would be good with donuts.
Yeah, it would be. And I actually have a piece here that, I could read from it or I could play a recording of it. We probably still haven't heard from our guest. You're not seeing anything in your email feed, are you?
Let me
yeah, you take a look. Yeah,
and I've got a wrong screen up.
I'll tell people Dunkelflaut. So this was in the New York Times recently. It means dark doldrums, and it's overshadowing Europe's energy markets. They're going through a period, one of the longer periods that they've experienced, of low sun and wind, a weather pattern known as a Dunkelflaut. That can increase electricity prices and stoke political tensions. And, until I hear back from Henry, I'll just go ahead and pull a couple things out of here. There have been agreements made between a lot of the European Union countries to share power. In other words, if one country is kind of running low and there are cables running under the North Sea connecting England and Scotland over to mainland Europe, where that energy can be transferred pretty easily. But now they're getting a little bit nervous and there's a little political unease in a lot of the countries. Like, why are we sending power that we're generating here to our friendly neighbors and having our own local energy prices go up, spike quite a bit? So there's a little tension there. And of course, we know geopolitically, France has been going through a really rough time, a lot of pressure to get their president to resign there. The far-right party in Germany is making some big strides. So this energy and geopolitical friction is really starting to come to a head. But that is your special word for the day, Dunkelflaut. I'll just read you a little bit from here. The cost of running these backup power plants when there's not enough solar or wind is a lot higher. It drives up prices when renewable sources are falling behind. That's from Steve Moody, who's the trading director at Conrad Energy, a power trading company in Abingdon, England, that supplies electricity to the grid through batteries and other sources. You will see high prices in periods of scarcity. During a stretch of low wind in mid-December, British power prices briefly jumped to £485 per megawatt hour. That is approximately seven times the average price during last year. Germany has also suffered a particularly gloomy fall and winter this year, and winter is just getting started, with electricity production down more than 5% compared with the same time the previous year. A Dunkelflaut in mid-December caused electricity prices to jump to 14 times their average. So pretty serious situation over there in Europe, Henry. And Henry's not back. Oh,
yeah,
he's there.
And
yep.
Vermont has long-term contracts, which gives us very stable electric rates. But when you get into states that that allow the electricity rate to follow the market instead of follow a long-term contract, then you get these big gyrations. And in a sense, if we got savvy, we could know that we were on a power price alert, and we could actually cut back on our electric usage in our houses for a period, because we do waste a lot of electricity. It's hard to change habits, but if you know that you are all of a sudden paying a much bigger price. Texas is the prime example of the state that has the price is changed in the market something like every 15 seconds. So it's just a continual roller coaster. And when they had big power outages, I don't know, 2-3 years ago, people landed up with $4,000 and $5,000 electric bills for 1 month.
Wow.
Was a shock to them.
Yeah, I bet.
So, $50 a month or something like that.
Right. So this Dunkelflaut, which I believe is still continuing as we start 2025, is causing, you know, a lot of shock to countries, not just the individual ratepayers. Norway involved here. Some power exporting countries, which Norway is, most of their power actually comes from hydro, they are threatening to turn to protectionism to buffer their citizens. Politicians in Norway have cast doubt on continuing to operate cables that bring Norwegian hydropower to Denmark, while Sweden has postponed building a second cable to Germany. Germany per capita is the highest energy user of any of the European Union countries. In France, officials of the far-right National Rally Party have also proposed curbing electricity exports from the country's fleet of nuclear power stations. The high recent prices have created this kind of political backlash, says a former Norwegian deputy energy minister. Yet the European energy system needs integration to be secure as you do the energy transition. Analysts like this gentleman are skeptical that there will be a major retreat from the interdependent European power market that has been constructed over several decades, but the friction may complicate the shift to cleaner energy, and with several more months of winter ahead, the next Dunkelflaut could be right around the corner. So, you know, as if we don't have enough things to worry about, Henry.
Well, this morning was the latest sunrise that we will have for the year. So when we meet this, make the solstice, we land up with equal day and night, or not equal day. We land up with the shortest day of the year back on the 21st of December. And since then, what's been happening is the days have been getting very slightly longer, but the sunrise and sunset times have been shifting. They do a weird wobble at this time of year. And I noticed it this morning that even though we were overcast, it was a long time getting light here in Burlington this morning. So that's part of the Dunkelflauting, I guess, is when you have short daylight hours, and certainly if you are living off of the solar you produce, November, December is between short daylight hours and overcast is a hard one to overcome. And when you get into January, you usually have a lot more sunny days. And even though the daylight hours haven't increased a lot, you tend to get substantial more power generation. So is that your experience? You're living off grid with solar, which is the real acid test for generating your own electricity rather than selling it back to the grid and then taking whatever you want.
Yeah, we're going through a period. We checked. Everybody checks the weather forecast. You don't need a weatherman. Actually, there's some that are online. We know that tomorrow is, there's a little glimpse of sun coming through today. We have a meter that shows kind of what the battery storage current capability is. And, you know, as usual, the green, yellow, and red. Normally, if we're getting a lot of sun like we're supposed to do tomorrow, it'll just about top the batteries off. If they're really topped off, that's the day we would run the most, you know, energy-using device that we have, which would be the washing machine. But if it starts to get into the lower green, not quite in the yellow, what you don't want to do with the battery backup is say, you know, let's go ahead and go into low yellow. It's okay. It's going to be sunny tomorrow. We might even get between yellow and red, because you are going to decrease the longevity and usefulness of those batteries, and they are very expensive. So we're not in a dire situation. I'd say if it was cloudy the next few days, and of course what we do every day, even when it's sunny, is nothing is on that doesn't need to be on. There is no phantom power. There's nothing drawing power. The refrigerator, actually, we did transfer from a gas refrigerator to an electric refrigerator. That is drawing some power. We've actually switched over our water source back to gravity-fed water, so we have a dual water system. So we're not using. We did have a deep well dug, and we can get water from there, and we have, but that requires a pump, and that pump, of course, uses energy. So it really makes you quite mindful of lights, other things you might be using. And as far as a typical night when we're on low power, there is one light on in the entire house where we're sitting. And if you move somewhere else, that light goes off and another light goes on somewhere. Does that answer your question, Henry?
Yeah, that's living with energy efficiency in mind. And I think we're just living in abundance of everything. In the U.S., and therefore we consume without regard. And there's something real about wood heat and, when you are getting cold, you have to pour more wood in the stove. It brings you a sense of reality about what's going on. And the same thing for generating your own electricity. It connects you with what's really happening rather than being sheltered from it. And I don't know, do you find that, I mean, people who are used to having just being able to turn on the lights and leave them on if they care to, or do their laundry or whatever they want to do, they probably think it's a tremendous hardship to pay attention. Do you find it restricts what you do, or do you find it you just get used to it and it all makes sense?
I'm going to choose answer B. it's not a hardship. You don't after you live this way for many, many years, you're not really even that conscious of what you're doing, because why would you, other than going, for instance, in our basement, there's a couple lights. You can kind of go down one and then to get the back part of the basement. And I have occasionally, not recently, left one of those lights on. And if my partner finds out, she lets me know right away, and I feel bad about it. It's just a question of, I was supposed to flick that switch off. So you just live with it day to day, and it's pretty straightforward. And yeah, whether it's a vehicle or using energy at home or transport, etc., once you start to make that transition, it is definitely not a hardship, and you feel pretty good about it. We've talked before on this show, Henry, about small things that people can do just in their daily lifestyle. They can't take on shutting the gas pipeline down in Europe, or we can't do anything about it now, who the next president is and how his, what his policies about energy policy are going to be, et cetera. But we can do these little things as far as, do I really need to drive somewhere every day? Probably not. Can you consolidate your driving so you're doing things? Can you carpool? Can you go and use the, advanced transit, et cetera? All those things, once you do them a few times, they really just become customary and you don't really think about it.
So speaking of dollars and cents and what the new administration will do, I think this can be a positive look at the kind of reading the tea leaves of what is coming under the Trump administration, and that is that if we look back at this last 2 years since the Inflation Reduction Act and the CHIPS Act got passed, that about $1 trillion worth of investment has been unlocked. And only a small portion of that has actually been paid out of the federal government. And the rest of it is that money has been leveraged and private industry has ramped up solar manufacturing, has ramped up battery manufacturing, has some of the federal money has paid to encourage the production of semiconductors that we are currently dependent on foreign markets for, and try to make it so we aren't so dependent on foreign markets, and that has unleashed money there. And what's interesting, and there's a link that I will put in the notes that isn't there. I've put some links in already for today's show, but there's a map in that link from the White House, from their evaluation. And it turns out a lot of that money is happening in red states. And I think there'll be a lot of pushback that will prevent the, even if the Trump administration wants to, say, hey, we want to get rid of all of this green stuff. We want to have it all be about fossil fuels, because so much of our money has been donated to our campaigns from fossil fuel. And they won't be able to do that. There will be pushback, and I think when the chips are down, there'll be it'll be a much more moderated approach to it. So I think there's positive news there.
Okay, well,
it's quite extensive.
Being a Libra, we're gonna get the balance, because now that was some good positive news. But also looking at some future administration plans. Looking at a story that was in the New York Times the other day, and I'm sure you heard about it, Henry. Trump wants Greenland and the Panama Canal, and the reason is it's about climate. Now, you probably have read stories about this. Do you want to give some details as to why some of these comments are being made by the incoming president and the administration to the leaders of both Panama and to Denmark, who are the territorial government of Greenland?
Well, you know, I saw a very interesting take on this.
Okay.
It seems just absolutely, I mean, it's the U.S. wanting to say, well, we don't like the prices you're charging us for moving freight through the Panama Canal, so we're just going to take it back over again. And Trump does this all the time. He starts pillow fights with burst pillows. And he does that in many cases to change the subject, to take away from, he was elected to try and, because prices were too high. And you could say that taking the freight over, you know, taking over the Panama Canal, quite separate of international law and all the rest of the ethics of it, that was, you know, that's a price-winning deal. But the reality is, when we ran the Panama Canal, I think the federal government probably put plenty of money into having that operate. And the fact that the Panamanians, who don't have a big tax base to pay for that, have raised the cost of transit through the Panama Canal, and have done significant improvements for it. Don't know if you remember, there was a ship that got cattywampus in there and shut down all travel in there for, 2 weeks while they figured out how to straighten it out and get it from blocking the waterway, and the container ships are getting bigger and bigger, and the canal hadn't been getting bigger. And so the Panamanians have actually been capitalizing and fixing it up and making it handle traffic better. So I don't think it's inappropriate that they charge more. Anyway, so I think that this is taking away from the fact that I don't think he has any intention of reducing grocery prices and the things that that are influencing the baseline expenses in the household, which really was a tight pinch caused by the COVID pandemic, and the U.S. came through it way better than other countries. So, but that doesn't mean that it was easy, and certainly not easy for people who were on tight budgets. So I think that this is Trump's approach to just changing the subject, whether he and bullying people, saying, "Oh well, you know, you do the right thing, or I'm going to get you." You know, he's just being a bully.
Let's spread the responsibility around a little bit, or as far as what the future could hold. And this is particularly with Greenland, with the ice sheet melting very rapidly, and Transarctic shipping opening up some sea lanes. A lot of countries are interested in that. A lot of big countries like Russia and China, and maybe even members of the European Union. So that move with trying to control that area that increasingly has more sea lanes opening up, and also the development of minerals and possibly more gas and oil in areas that were completely inaccessible, seems to be playing a role in this little chess match that's going on an international basis concerning Greenland. So we're not going to just lay it all on the feet of the threats of President Trump. You know, I want to shift here for a moment, Henry. I'm thinking, you know, our guests hopefully will be with us next week, and it is Pat Parento talking about this case, monumental case that came down in Montana. We'll try to have him on the air next week. But I'm going to put a little bit of music on, and then we're going to, you know, look at the environmental legacy, the positive environmental legacy of a president that we just lost the other day. And, of course, that would be President Jimmy Carter. So we'll come back to Green Zine in just a moment with that. We've got about 21 minutes left in the show, and we're going to play a little bit of music from a great Canadian artist on the banjo. This is Hannah Shira Naaman. You are listening to Green Zine here on Royalton Community Radio. And it is a waltz. Hannah Shira Nyman there. Boy, I knew we would get birds back on the air. What'd you think of that piece of music, Henry?
I like it. It has a nice waltz swing to it.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of echoing in the voices of the mockingbird. But let's move away from the incoming administration. Take a look back at the, particularly the conservation legacy of the late president. Jimmy Carter just passed away in the last week at the age of 100. He was our 39th president. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff going around. This is taken from a news outlet that I think you subscribe to. Henry, you've mentioned Greenwire on the air before, haven't you? You familiar with
Yes.
Greenwire? Yeah. Yeah. I think they're maybe a subset of Politico. So I'll just read a little bit and we can talk about it. This is primarily dealing with an area in Alaska called, well, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, which Carter signed on December 2nd of 1980. When Jimmy Carter became an honorary National Park Ranger, wow, that's a position I'd like to get to, back in 2016, his supporters had little doubt that the former president deserved the highest civilian award from the National Park Service. Carter's aggressive conservation push in the late 1970s resulted in the creation of 39 new park sites. And with the stroke of a pen, in early December of 78, he uses his executive authority to designate 13 national monuments in Alaska alone, giving federal protection to 56 million acres of new land and more than doubling the amount of land managed by the National Park Service. That was incredibly, incredibly bold, said former NPS Director John Jarvis, who had gone to Carter's hometown of Plains, Georgia, to present the former president with a plaque and a broad-brimmed Ranger's hat. Of all the American presidents, Carter arguably made the biggest impact on both the Park Service and the state of Alaska, the nation's longest-living president, of course, died last Sunday at the age of 100. So what a legacy to leave behind there in Alaska and, of course, parks in the other part of the country.
Yeah, and he, you know, he famously put solar panels on the roof of the White House.
Yes, he did.
And, you know, he saw what was coming. And I think that the fact that he told people they need to turn the heat down, wear a sweater inside, was some of his political undoing.
Yeah, I remember actually watching that national address on television, and he was sitting there with the sweater. And to go back to your earlier point about, well, how difficult by making changes like that is it going to be for the average American? And, you know, you put on a heavier sweater and turn down your thermostat by 2 degrees so that we can save oil. I mean, it really wasn't, but it was taken as a very big deal, and he definitely suffered some blowback from that.
Yeah, yeah. He was logical, but he was, you know, he was extraordinary as a president because he continued to do things that were just marvelous for the world, doing his best for the world.
Mm-hmm.
The whole rest of his life, he didn't go back into retirement and twiddle his thumbs. He did Habitat for Humanity.
He helped the Camp David Accords, and that accord made, I think, in about 1978 or 79 between Israel and Egypt, basically a treaty between Anwar Sadat, who was the president of Egypt at the time, if I got it backwards? No, I think that's correct. And then Menachem Begin was the president of Israel and brought them to Camp David, you know, an hour west of the White House there in Washington, got them to sign off, and that was almost 50 years ago, and that peace treaty still holding firm, despite a lot of difficulty in other parts of the world. So you're right.
It is a little glimmer of hope for holding that part of the world together.
Mm-hmm.
There's not much else that's holding it together, except for maybe My view of it is that the Israeli intention is just to dominate it all and stamp their foot and crush anybody who's in the way. I appreciate the fact that it's not nice to have neighbors who are firing missiles at you and invading your borders, but just seems war doesn't, the threat of war may be useful for maintaining peace, but the actuation of war seems like just a total waste of everything else, that it's waste of humans, a waste of capital, a waste of there's no positive to come from it.
To circle back to this show, which is, of course, a show about the environment, sustainability, renewable energy, and everything, the environmental consequences of warfare are just almost incalculable these days with the weapons, the amount of fossil fuels that are used just to create the weaponry, much less use the weaponry, what it does to the scorched land. For instance, the agricultural sector in Ukraine obviously has been devastated. Used to be the largest wheat producer in the world. I don't know if it'll ever be able to return to that. So, the environmental legacy of armed conflict has never had a good result as far as the planet goes, much less humanity.
Yeah.
Hey, let's shift gears.
The agricultural land.
Yep.
Yep.
So I have in front of me.
We're going to say a lot of that agricultural land gets left cluttered with landmines, which then makes it not very plowable.
Yeah, so we've been kind of doing a national and global perspective most of the way. We hope next week, if we can get Professor Pat Parento to join us to talk about that landmark case handed down by the state Supreme Court, affirming a lower court in favor of some very young people there who said that, you know, the policies of state government as far as fossil fuels and emissions violates the state constitution, and that was upheld by the state Supreme Court. So hopefully we'll talk more about that next week. But let's go local here. Sustainable Woodstock is a nonprofit organization that we often tell people about, and they are going to be presenting another film in their Upper Valley Climate Change and Sustainability Film Series. It's still a couple weeks away, so you can plan for it. It's going to be available virtually, so you can Zoom in and not have to pay anything. And the film is called Inventing Tomorrow, and it's going to be available for 3 days, the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th of January. And it follows young scientists from Indonesia, Hawaii, India, and Mexico as they tackle some of the most complex environmental issues facing humanity today, right in the countries where they live. Each student is preparing original scientific research that he or she will defend at ISEF, the Intel International Science and Engineering Fair, framed against the backdrop of the severe environmental threats we now face. We immerse the audience in a global view of the planetary crisis through the eyes of the generation that will be affected by it most. So, sir, more young people, you know, standing up and stand up for your rights. The next Green Drinks that Sustainable Woodstock is at the end of the month, and it's very pertains to this time of year. It's going to be a Green Drinks Home Weatherization with Efficiency Vermont. That will also be virtual. You can get all this information at their website, sustainablewoodstock.org. So there are a couple local things that you can tune into and get your awareness up to a good level.
Yeah. And I'd kind of like to loop back to the business of gas pipelines. And as we move off fossil fuel, what happens to them? And there's a group within Vermont 350 that is working on making the transition to using the infrastructure that is left behind as we stop delivering natural gas. So that's especially the West part of the state and down into Rutland. That's where the natural gas distribution lines are primarily in the state of Vermont. But, you know, the gas company has an investment in those, and those can be used for ground source heat pumps to produce heating and cooling at a much lower cost per unit of energy. It's an efficient, very much more efficient system than using air source heat pumps. So if you're interested in doing that, look up the Vermont 350 committees, and you'll find one on geothermal. And I've put in the notes a link to Volt's most recent podcast, which is all about the different ways that you can use those gas pipelines and use the different ways of distributing heat and cold. And there's a number of different games you can play that make use of some of that infrastructure that cranks up the efficiency of the system and reduces the cost, therefore. So
I have surfed over to Energy Action Network, and Jared Duvall, who we've interviewed a couple times, has put out a newsletter. This goes back a couple of weeks, but it's mentioning events that are coming up, particularly from VCAN, another notable environmental nonprofit based in Montpelier. Don't forget that our legislators return to Montpelier next week, and they will be in session there right until early May. So if there are some, and not if, there are going to be plenty of environmental issues being discussed in some bills, and particularly as far as group net metering goes. But coming up on January 15th, VCAN is offering, speaking of the legislature, a webinar. So this is going to happen on January 15th. It's a legislative session preview. Join them for their first webinar of their annual winter webinar series on timely clean energy and climate-focused topics from interested community leaders, stakeholders, and partners. Hear from policy experts across a broad array of climate resilience, water, and other environmental issues to learn about the state of the Vermont legislature and what issues will be key in 2025. Henry, I forget who our contact is at VCAM, but possibly in the next week or two, we could get a guest on to talk about some of those issues that are going to be discussed in the legislature and that will be discussed also in that webinar on January the 15th. The very next day, Electrifying Research, Rewiring America will be putting on a program. That's Thursday, January 16th at 2 p.m. And finally, at the end of the month, a webinar once again presented by VCAN, New Vermont Bond Bank Loan Program, a significant cost and pollution-reducing opportunity for communities. So a lot going on out there in the energy efficiency and sustainability world here in Vermont.
Yes, and it all counts dearly.
Yeah, it really does.
We need to turn this world around.
So, Henry, I've got a little bit of music playing under us. We've got about 4 minutes left in the show, but I'm going to turn it back to you.
Okay. So let's see where we can go from here.
Oh, we can always go somewhere. I've always got EVs on my mind, Henry. So here's one from Green Car Reports, and it's pretty good news. It says that the build-out of the infrastructure for EV charging has kept up with the growth, and it's staying fixed a little longer than it used to do. It's gained reliability. Recent data suggests infrastructure has built out to handle peak EV charging demand. A lot of this was based on the Thanksgiving holiday when they figured the number of EVs driving around the country long distances were using the charging network. And there weren't too many failures. There are about 50% more public charging connectors in the country in this past year than there was in the previous year. So it's grown by 50%, the number of chargers. Public EV charging is making progress in reliability, and there have been a lot of criticisms about pulling up to chargers that are non-functioning. So that's some pretty good news. We like to end the show on some good news.
Yes, indeed. And I think that this is a quickie on this, I guess.
Okay.
The AI, I've been following artificial intelligence, and I think it's coming on more and more. And they're saying that it's being used even in small businesses. And I certainly notice it when I do internet searches that I'm getting a better collection of information, kind of an overview, a quick overview, and then I can dig into particular things. And that this is going to increase productivity for the country. It's also going to increase power demands.
Yes.
And that will be an issue. But I think we can ramp that up. We just need to be aware it's coming at us and make sure that we generate more. And I saw in a notice from the outgoing head of the Biden administration's energy department, their comments to what would the note I'd leave on my desk for the incoming administration, and it's do all of it, do all of it. Yes, chase gas if you want to, and oil, but chase sustainables as well. Do it all.
I don't know about that advice, but we'll have to see where this all leads. Hey, we're into our final minute here on Green Zine. Want to thank all of you for supporting us over these almost 12 years of doing this broadcast here at Royalton Community Radio, WFVR LP, right here in South Royalton, Vermont. And also the specific underwriters that have kept this show going, and they include the White River Land Collaborative, also Wit and Grit, the First Branch Coffee Company, Solarfest, White River, I did them already, Upper Pass Beer Company, Soliflect, Bale, and Royal Trail Works. A whole lot of great folks, and Daniel Leibowitz as well. Henry, we're going to end up with a little bit of music. Thanks for joining me, and hopefully we'll be able to get Professor Parento on with us next week. Coming up next, Democracy Now! Here at, let me pull this up a little bit more. All right, Henry, see you next week.
See you next week, and maybe we'll have better luck connecting with our guests.
We will. All right. See ya.